All right, you may be seated. The younger children are dismissed down to Children's Church. All right, and today we have for you Ted again. Come back. He must have liked us enough that he's willing to say yes to come back again, so thank you. All right.
Chris? Good morning. It is good to be back with you guys again. And, I get the cordless mic, so I don't need that, and I can't help. I'm sorry if this like messes up the view from the new camera you guys have, but I'm a wanderer. I can't stand still, so you just have to deal with that. Sorry. We can. It's fine there either way. Thanks, Chris. So I think it's kind of fascinating that at Christmas time, we have 4 weeks of Advent before Christmas, 4 weeks of preparation to like mentally, spiritually get yourself centered in on what happened. God stepped down to earth, into a body like ours, and like we just need some time to really take in what is it, what happened, and how that affects us, so that when we celebrate Christmas, we really are celebrating Christmas fully. But for Easter, what happened? Why don't we do that? So this really is a preparation for Easter. It deserves at least 2 weeks. You know, Palm Sunday is a bit of preparation for Easter, so yeah. But it deserves at least 2 weeks. So we kind of want to start to get ourselves centered in on what happened when Christ went to the cross. What was that he did for us there? And he helps us out because Jesus explains everything. Like all the teaching he did, all that time he spent, his primary goal was to come to the cross for us. That was it. But he spent 3 years before that teaching, healing, everything he did. What was the purpose of that? To help us understand and really take in what he did there. So we have plenty to work with to get ourselves prepared for Easter, and particularly John's gospel does a great job of honing in on that. John wrote his gospel last of all the gospels, and early in the church there was already starting misunderstandings of who Jesus is, because it's understandable. It's hard for us to get our heads around this one being, unlike everyone else ever, is both God and human, which we're just going to spend our lives processing that, getting that really into our understanding. And so John, his gospel is so unique and helpful for us in that, because that's what he focused in on. All the things that Jesus said and the way he healed people and how what those healings meant and all the things he did in that time leading up to the resurrection were about John spelling out for us the pieces we need to focus in on to really get our heads around and our hearts around what it means that Jesus died on the cross for us. And right in the middle of that is this great place to go, chapters 9 and 10, because it's right at the kind of the cross section between early in his ministry, Jesus a lot of times was saying, don't tell anybody who I am. He was almost like downplaying who he was. It almost seems foolish, but he needed some events to take place because he knew that a portion of the Jewish leadership was going to misunderstand him and come against him, and they would be the ones who would take him to the cross. And as hard as it is for us to get our heads around it, it was necessary for him to go to the cross. So, in this time when Jesus is switching from I'm just starting my ministry to we're now resolutely heading toward the cross. Okay, and it literally says Jesus set out resolutely for Jerusalem because that's the place where he's going to face the cross. And along the way, we hit one of these in chapter 9. We hit one of the times when he healed somebody that starts to give Jesus an opportunity to start to really clearly spell out what's going on here. It's the time when he has been becoming more and more popular. As he has touched and healed more people understand who he is and they're flocking to him. And at that time, the Jewish leadership, the religious leaders, were mixed. Some people, we know Nicodemus specifically, met and talked to Jesus and came to know who he really is, that he is the Messiah. And we know there were others. But there were some who were threatened by Jesus. And it's kind of funny that the last worship song we just sang, you hear the words in there about how the things of earth will fade away. Well, for some of the religious leadership, that didn't happen. The things of earth were what mattered to them. They were all about their position as a leader and having all the respect from people and people doing what they told them to do. And because Jesus was getting attention, they were threatened by it. And their focus on earthly things took them to the point of just going against Jesus. Like, we just need to get rid of this guy. And that turmoil kept building and building and building. And by the time Jesus gets to Jerusalem and spends several days there ministering and healing and teaching, they're just out to get him. They're literally out to find a way to kill him, and they're doing anything they can. So this is where we find ourselves in chapters 9 and 10 of John's Gospel. And they come along, and I'm going to skip a little bit through 9. So I'm in the beginning of chapter 9, and they come along this point where it says they pass by a man who is blind from birth. In chapter 2, verse 9, and his disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he would be born blind?" Jesus answered, "It was neither that this man sinned nor his parents, but it was so that the works of God might be displayed in him." So already Jesus is in this miracle stopping to spell something out a little bit more. It's really fascinating that every miracle that happens has a little bit of nuance. One of them, Jesus was never in contact with the person healed, the daughter of the centurion. He never went to the guy's house because he praised the faith that this man had and demonstrated he doesn't have to be there, that he could heal this person without even being in contact with him. Like, every healing has a little bit of nuance that teaches us something. And this particular one teaches us something about all of them, is that the point of all of them is for us to know who Jesus is. Jesus didn't heal every sick person that was there. He hasn't healed every sick person since. His point in those healings was not just to take care of the physical condition. Even though he healed this blind man, it certainly had a dramatic impact on this man's earthly life, right? So he did impact people that way, but that wasn't the purpose. When you focus on God's purpose, you go, what was he really doing there? That man still was going to struggle with other things. Even though he wasn't blind anymore, he was still going to face death like all of us do. All the struggles of life were still there for that man. How he really healed that man was spiritually, and we're going to see that as we keep looking a little bit further. So it goes on to say that when he had said this, I skipped to verse 6 here, he spat on the ground and made clay of the spittle and applied the clay to his eyes and said to him, "Go wash in the pool of Siloam," which is translated sent. So he went away and washed and came back seeing. So he did impact this man physically. In fact, another little interesting thing in this particular healing is the sense of physical touch, the very personal nature of Jesus interacting with this man. He makes mud and he smears it on his eye. And we might go, "Gross, come near me with mud," you know. But this man didn't, because he was being healed by Jesus, and this sense of him, like, personally touching, the personal interaction with Jesus, it even goes beyond that to the point he sends the man away. What's the point of that? Was it necessary for this man to wash the mud off in the pool? Is that what actually healed his eyes? No. Why did Jesus do that? Because everything God does, he's always drawing us in to be part of it. Nothing in this man washing his eyes in the pool made his eyes better. But God constantly pulls us into what he's doing. Even though we're helpless in it, he's constantly pulling us into what he's doing. And make note of that at this point. The very personal drawing you in nature of Jesus interacting with people, the relational nature of that. Well, then we find out that this causes a lot of turmoil, because the man comes back from the pool, he's been healed, and first all his neighbors go, "What, this can't be this guy." Some of them are going, "Yeah, that's him." Others are going, "No, it can't be, because he's been blind since birth." And so they finally turn around and send him off to the religious leaders, who we know at this point are really in turmoil over Jesus. And the religious leaders are all in a kerfuffle about it, and asking the guy, "Well, how did this happen? Who did this to you?" And he says, "This man Jesus did this to me." And it ends up in verse 16, after they've kind of, he's explained what happened, they say, therefore some of the Pharisees were saying, this man is not from God. He does not keep the Sabbath. But others were saying, how can a man who is a sinner perform such signs? So we have a lot of controversy in the religious leaders. Remember, these are the religious leaders appointed by God to help the people draw into right relationship with God. And right now, at this point, they're in nothing but controversy. And then it says in verse 18, the Jews then did not believe it of him, that he had been blind and received his sight, until they called the parents of the very one who had received his sight. So they quiz his parents, and his parents go, well, we can verify for you that he has been blind since birth, yes, but we don't know how. They're afraid because they don't want to get kicked out of the temple, because that's what the religious leaders would do. And so they go, well, we don't know how this happened. Ask him. So they go back to him, and they ask him again, you know, how did this happen? Who did this to you? And specifically, listen to what they said to him. In verse 24, it says, so a second time, they called the man who had been blind and said to him, give glory to God. We know that this man is a sinner. He then answered, whether he is a sinner or not, I do not know. One thing I do know, that though I was blind, now I see. Now, really fascinating that the religious leaders who are supposed to be about helping people draw closer to God, when they face God in person, in human form in front of them, they go, we know that this man is a sinner. They've drawn conclusion already. And we're going to see this contrast between Jesus and how they are further. When we jump down to verse 30, and we hear that the man answered and said to them, well, here is an amazing thing, that you do not know where he is from, and yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not hear sinners, but if anyone is God-fearing and does his will, he hears him. Since the beginning of time, it has never been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a person born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. They answered him, you are entirely in sins, and are you teaching us? So they put him out. They expelled him from the temple. It goes on to say, Jesus heard that they had put him out, and finding him, he said, do you believe in the Son of Man? He answered, who is he, Lord, that I may believe him? Jesus said to him, you have both seen him, and he is the one who is talking with you. And he said, Lord, I believe. And he worshiped him. And Jesus said, for judgment I came into this world, so that those who do not see may see, and that those who see may become blind. That contrast Jesus just pointed out is the pivotal point right in the middle of the Gospels. The pivotal point between those who can see and those who don't. So this man who is healed is doubly healed. He's physically healed of his sight, which, as we mentioned, drastic impact on his physical life. But far, far greater is his spiritual healing. Through the physical healing, he recognizes who Jesus is. This is God standing before me. He's in God's presence. Notice, like in our worship songs, we talk about coming into God's presence because that's what we need. That's what we need more than anything, is to be in God's presence. And when this man was able to stand before God, he was able to recognize it because of the way he was healed. And so, in that culture, you're born blind, you never learn to read or write, you're as uneducated as they get, and you live your life as a beggar. So here is this beggar, uneducated, nothing, who's pointing out to the scholars who are supposed to be the visionaries pointing people how to have a right relationship with God. And he's the one who's drawing the correct conclusion that this man has been able to do what no one else can do, has ever been able to do. Can't be done unless God blesses him. And how is it? And they were even asking the question, are you going to teach us? But literally he did, had they been listening. And so Jesus, what Jesus said in that final statement was just saying what he saw right in front of him. I just caused the blind to be able to see doubly, physically and spiritually. While at the same time, those who should be seeing are blinded. What are they blinded by? That worldly view. Their love of their position, their expectation that God's going to do things in the way they expect and they're going to be big somebodies in that. That worldly view is what kept them from being able to see the truth. And as a result, all they can do is turmoil. All they're capable of is fighting. They're divided amongst themselves. They're fighting against God incarnate on earth. They're looking to try to kill God incarnate on earth while they fight amongst themselves. All they're capable of is worldly turmoil because they're spiritually blinded. So here it goes. From there, it steps. Oh, one more thing I wanted to point out. This also kind of harkens back just to get the perspective on where these spiritual leaders are. And again, not all of them. We know there were some. The division was some understood to some degree. There's got to be a reason why this man's able to do these things. So some were trying to understand who Jesus was. But some were clearly so caught into a worldly view. The way in Matthew that Jesus describes him is like this from Matthew 23. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you tithe mint and dill and cumin and have neglected the weightier provisions of the law, justice and mercy and faithfulness. But these are the things you should have done without neglecting the others, you blind guides who strain out a gnat and swallow a camel. You get caught up on some little detail, like, oh, he healed on the Sabbath. He can't possibly be God because he did this thing. They focus on some nitpick because they're unwilling to just see who he is. They're blind guides. And it says again in, calls them again blind in verse 26. This is from Matthew 23. You blind Pharisee, first clean the inside of the cup and the dish so that the outside of it may become clean also. And then finally in verse, everybody wait patiently while I turn my page. In verse 28, he says, so you too outwardly appear righteousness to men, but inwardly you are full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. And that's what I wanted us to remember, is the end result of this blindness they have, the end result of them failing to see God incarnate in their midst, is the worldly view consumes them. It's nothing but chaos and lawlessness and turmoil. They're fighting against each other. They're fighting with the Romans. They're fighting with everybody. Because if you focus on it and just be part of the world, it will consume you in that way. So from this point, Jesus, in the beginning of verse 10 of John's Gospel, all of a sudden shifts to this allegory we know as the Good Shepherd. It starts like this. Verse 10, very beginning, verse 1. Truly, truly, I say to you, he who does not enter by the door into the fold of the sheep, but climbs up some other way, he is a thief and a robber. But he who enters by the door is a shepherd of the sheep. To him the doorkeeper opens, and the sheep hear his voice. And he calls his own sheep by name, and he leads them out. When he puts forth all his own, he goes ahead of them, and the sheep follow him because they know his voice. A stranger they simply will not follow, but will flee from him because they do not know the voice of strangers. This figure of speech Jesus spoke to them, but they did not understand what those things were which he had been saying to them. Seems a little odd. We're right in the middle of all this turmoil, all this kerfuffle going on. And all of a sudden, Jesus breaks into the Good Shepherd story. And you can tell the apostles are like, I'm not getting what this means. Where did we get to a shepherd from blindness? What's the correlation? By the way, blindness and sight, one of the biggest themes through all of Scripture. And so very significant theme, but all of a sudden now we're talking about a shepherd. Who flipped the page here and I didn't catch it? And so Jesus has to go on and explain it further. So Jesus said to them again, truly, truly, I say to you, I am the door of the sheep. And all who came before me are thieves and robbers. But the sheep did not hear them. I am the door. If anyone enters through me, he will be saved, and I will go in and out and find pasture. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I came that they may have life and have it abundantly. This is still the same theme going on. Jesus hasn't switched pages. He's switched the analogy to help them to understand, and they eventually do. Look at the way the interaction of a shepherd with its sheep is very much like the interaction of these religious leaders with their flock compared to Jesus. Their ways are about stealing and robbing. They're about getting something for themselves, their position, their power. It's all about getting something for themselves. They can only create turmoil. They're thieves and robbers, as opposed to the good shepherd. You hear the difference on how a true shepherd interacts with his flock. It's personal. He knows them. It's relational. He knows their voice. They know his voice. He calls them by name. He's named every one of them. It's very individual and personal, like him putting mud on this man's eyes. It's a very personal, individual touch. There are so many places in Scripture that our relationship with God is referred to in a very family, communal kind of ways. Okay, we are constantly, and I think we have a tendency sometimes to focus so much on the individual and our own selves that God's always keeping us aware that this is part of a bigger picture thing that's a unity of all of us. It's a community. But this is one of the places where it stops and focuses on the very individual, personal level. Because ultimately, this shepherd is about each and every one of his sheep individually. He is building a community, yes. But each individual is going to make the choice to understand him or not, to follow him or not. And each individual one, he is going to have relationship with. So the contrast is just very starkly there between a false leader, these Jewish leaders who are falsely leading them, and Jesus, who's the good shepherd. But it goes on to help us understand a little bit better the nature of the good shepherd. Now I got to find my spot. Bear with me. So this is in verse 11. So after he's kind of done out this contrast, I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for his sheep. He who is a hired hand and not a shepherd, who is not the owner of the sheep, sees the wolf coming and leaves the sheep and flees. And the wolf snatches them and scatters them. He flees because he is a hired hand and is not concerned about the sheep. I am the good shepherd, and I know my own, and my own know me. Even as the Father knows me, and I know the Father, and I lay my life down for the sheep. I have other sheep, which are not of this fold. I must bring them also, and they will hear my voice, and they will become one flock with one shepherd. For this reason, the Father loves me, because I lay down my life so that it may be taken up, that I may take it again. No one has taken it away from me, but I lay it down on my own initiative. I have authority to lay it down, and I have authority to take it up again. This commandment I received from my Father. Now here he's really spelling out the fullness of this plan that is leading him to the cross at this moment. And remember, these guys standing there are clueless. He's been saying to them, I need to go and be crucified and be killed now. We're heading to my death, and they've been baffled by it for days. So they're still having a hard time understanding, but his plan and purpose is behind it. And we have, first of all, the foundation of why is it all Jesus? Why is the center of our faith Jesus? With very good reason, because he's the owner of the sheep. No one else can make that claim. John has been very clear from the beginning of his gospel. He describes Jesus as the Word, and he says, the Word was there in the beginning, and nothing was made that was not made by him. Spelling out very clearly, this man speaking about a good shepherd being the owner of his sheep is the God who created them. He is the God who created them, who has become incarnate, taken on human form to be at that level of relationship with him. He's talking about, I know my sheep and they know me. We have a depth of relationship that can't exist anywhere else because no one else can make claim to be the owner of the sheep. He's their creator. He can care for them the way they need to be cared for. And so everybody else, we have the thieves and robbers that are just going to come in and cause turmoil. That's anybody who just refuses to hear God and focus on a worldly perspective. Even a hired hand. Even a leader who God puts into place, a pastor, these religious leaders, even the ones that were hearing God, can't be the protector like the true shepherd himself. They will do their best. They've got a different motive and perspective. They're not just stealing and robbing. They're trying to help the owner of the sheep. But ultimately, when things get scary, people run. This is the only shepherd who can care for his sheep. Jesus Christ, God incarnate, and then he ties it into the plan and purpose. You ever wonder why all of a sudden in the midst of this story he's talking about being the good shepherd? And he goes, oh, and I've got other sheep too, not from this flock, but I'm going to bring them in and they're going to follow me. It's very similar. They know my voice, same kind of thing. Well, this is for the Jewish people, understanding themselves to be God's one chosen people, thought we're the only ones God's about saving. And this is where he starts to clue them in. They're going to find a whole lot more going forward as we get into the book of Acts that God is not just about saving the Jewish nation. He's about all of his creation. So there are others outside of this flock of the nation of Israel who he's going to call into, and it's forming this community, this family that Jesus has been talking about family since the beginning of the Bible, about building a family, a community that's amazing and incredible. And behind it is incredible intention. I mean, you think about it. Creation itself took God's intention. He made us for the purpose of relationship with him. Then he steps down into this world, takes on human form, hard enough to get your head around that. But now he's saying at this point, just days before he's going to hang on a cross for us, I lay my life down for these sheep, and I will take it up again. He will be resurrected. And I do this by choice. My Father sent me because this is part of our plan to build the relationship. This is where we're going. This isn't haphazard or random. This is and has been God's plan all along. You hear Jesus have a lot of emotion in this time leading up to Calvary because he feels the emotion of people, but he's very clear on this is happening for a reason and I'm going there by choice because these are my sheep. I know them and they know me. And you can also keep in mind, I'm going to read just a little section from Revelations. When he's talking about this plan, then he's taking this sheep somewhere. His Father sent him. They're on a path. Go to Revelation 21. And in verse 3, we're going to hear what that ultimate goal of that plan is. This is always a good verse, just a couple of verses to keep in mind, because this is God's plan. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, now the dwelling of God is with men, and he will live with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away. So the good shepherd, who has chosen at this point to lay himself down for his sheep, is establishing a new kind of relationship. We have a tendency, and this is the place where we connect with this in our preparation for Easter. How does it affect you and I? Because it's a nice allegory. It's a cute little story. The Good Shepherd always sounds really great. It's great to teach our children, but it sounds almost simplistic to us, the Good Shepherd. because we have no idea what it's like to be a shepherd. That's not the kind of world we live in. We're a technology world. And when's the last time anyone here has really been concerned about a wolf showing up in your yard? You know, we're worried about stray dogs and cats, not wolves. But stop and think for a minute. Do we still live in a world of thieves and robbers? The wolf was just the thief and the robber in the world of the shepherd. Are we still worried about getting cyber hacked or having identity theft? Or having lies told to our children that lead them into all kinds of trouble? Or having lies told about ourselves? Do we still live in a world of turmoil? A world where entering deeply into that worldly perspective leads to nothing but fighting and chaos and turmoil and pain. And God says, I'm leading someplace different. I'm taking my sheep to a place where I can take them out to pasture and they will be safe. This is lived out in our world where we know what it's like to be worried about thieves and robbers. For all the advancements we have in this time, we still live fairly nervous lives. There's constantly somebody we're worried about or praying for because of the turmoil in our lives. We still need a good shepherd. This is the one good shepherd who's the only one who's made us, the only one who owns us, the only one who can truly care for us. And with the greatest of intention, he said, I came and I laid down my life for you. As personal and up close as it can get. So this is our preparation for Easter. We stop and consider personally, individually, this Jesus who drew you to this point. You're sitting here this morning because he drew you here. We sang together about hearing his voice because we spend time in his word to get more familiar with his voice every week. We hear him talking about hearing, having us follow him, and we sing our worship songs in which we say, we're here to follow after you. Guide us, lead us. And it says the good shepherd walks ahead of his sheep and guides them. That's what we're here for. That's what our Easter focus is for. And also, if there's anyone here this morning who isn't in that place where this is your shepherd, if you're here and he's not your shepherd because you've not yet chosen to follow him, now is always the right time to hear this very personal shepherd who's laid down his life for each one of us. He's gathered us together in this place to follow after him. And all you have to do is recognize you need a shepherd. You need salvation. And you can follow him. And if that is you and you want to follow him, I urge you to take some time to talk to one of the elders this morning. Get grounded in that and follow that path. So let's just take a moment now, and I want to ask you, just take a moment and think about, who is this Jesus who says to you, each and every one of you, I am the good shepherd. Those are his words to you, that he's going to take care of you no matter what your circumstances look like. He's going to take care of you and your family. He's building a community that's going to live an altogether different life. When he promises eternity, it's not just more of this turmoil that we've been living and seeing. It's a different kind of family where his values keep us together and keep us safe. That's where we're headed. That's where our good shepherd is leading us. Let's listen intently for his voice. I want to ask you just to take a minute and just focus in on who he is to you, speak to him. And then I'll close us in prayer before we finish in worship this morning. Lord Jesus, our shepherd, we do need you.